Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along on this cold winter's evening, where Dr. Rebecca Huntley makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here some years ago talking about an earlier book. Tonight she's going to talk about her most recent book, The Italian Girl, and the topic for tonight is Losing and Finding Italy Down Under. I'll introduce Dr. Huntley briefly. She's a researcher and author with a background in publishing, academia and politics. She holds degrees in law and film studies and a PhD in gender studies. Rebecca Huntley is executive director of the Ipsos Mackay Report and the author of two books, The World According to Y, Inside the New Adult Generation, and Eating Between the Lines, Food and Equality in Australia. She's also, of course, a commentator on television and radio, a writer. She's a feature writer for Vogue Australia and many other things, but tonight she's here to talk about her new book. Rebecca Huntley, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be speaking at the Sydney Institute again. I want to thank both Anne and Gerard for the invitation, and I also want to congratulate them on their invaluable work for the Institute. I find it hard to imagine Australian public life without them. I'm here tonight to talk about my memoir, The Italian Girl, which follows my decade-long search for answers about my family history and also explores my identity as a third-generation migrant. You might have noticed, looking around us at the moment, that there has been an upsurge in interest in family history in Australia. Consider the popularity of the TV show Who Do You Think You Are? Walk into any state library and you'll encounter people trying to trace their family tree back beyond their grandparents. Travel with a family history bent is now very popular, with Australians returning to a great-grandmother's birthplace in China or Italy or Greece, travelling to battlefields in Asia or Europe to see where a great-grandfather fought and died. However, what might have sparked this engagement with the personal past, whatever kind of trend, I think it's a wonderful development for many reasons. Firstly, it engages people necessarily with our nation's history, given so many of us, well, at least in my generation, found Australian history incredibly boring at school. Rediscovering it as an adult and finding a new relevance has got to be a positive thing. Secondly, understanding the lives of our ancestors can provide us with much-needed perspective on our own lives. We may complain that times are tough and life is stressful, petrol prices are up, cheese is more expensive, but the majority of us live extraordinary lives of opportunity and luxury compared to our distant and not-so-distant relatives. My interest in family history started 12 years ago with the death of my maternal grandmother, my nonna Teresa. She was just over 90 years old and died peacefully in a hospital bed in Innisfail, North Queensland. For those of you who don't know where Innisfail is, it's near Cairns and it's at the centre of a sugar-growing industry in North Queensland. When my nonna died, extraordinary stories about her life during the Second World War emerged. I found out that almost all of the men in my family had been interned as enemy aliens during the Second World War, and my grandmother, my quiet, unassuming grandmother, was the only family member with decent spoken and written English, and she had to step up and run three large, prosperous cane farms owned by her father, Luigi. My nonna was unmarried and in her late 20s, which was uncommon for an Italian woman of her generation. And she was told she had to leave the sweltering timber kitchen she worked in 6 days a week, cooking four meals a day for the cane cutters on her father's farm. She was suddenly thrust into the role of farm administrator, responsible for her father's checkbook, for the hiring and firing of men, for dealing with the lawyer, the accountant, and the all-powerful mill manager, She had custody of the family car, and she had to learn to fire the shotgun kept underneath the front seat. She had to learn to drive a truck and learn to drive a tractor. And she became the family's only advocate in a wider world at a time of extreme uncertainty and fear for Italians and non-Italians alike. I'd always wrongly assumed my grandmother was a loving but uncomplicated person, content with her life as a housewife. I thought she had chosen her life and that we were miles apart in our outlook and aspiration. This proved to be quite an arrogant assumption. Everything I uncovered about my grandmother since her death showed me that we were probably more similar than different. If she had been born today, educated and given the kind of freedom I've always enjoyed, I doubt she would have lived in Innisfail because she loved the city. I doubt she would have married my grandfather, who was her first cousin. And I doubt she would have stayed a housewife. Her time running the farms, which she did very well, showed she had a knack for business and handling people. And judging by her interests and her talents, I kind of imagine her that she could have run a small shop or taught dressmaking or become a photographer. The story of women left to work on the home front while their men were at war is one I was familiar with from high school history lessons. I knew about the many women who worked as nurses, the women who worked in factories, and the women who worked as part of the Women's Land Army. I never thought there was a parallel story in my own family history. However, the women in my family were not temporarily widowed by men sent overseas to fight, but by men who were interned in purpose-built camps in the South Australian desert. These were enemy aliens who were interned in their thousands, many for many years, to prevent the development of a fifth column in Australian soil. The story of internment in Australia is one that has only really recently attracted widespread academic interest. When I've mentioned the topic of my book to friends or colleagues or acquaintances, they've often been surprised that Australia interned residents from Axis countries during the war, and they seem more familiar with internment practices in the United States than here. It's a topic that's not comprehensively covered in our history syllabuses in high school either. And perhaps more crucially, former internees have been quite reluctant to tell their internment stories, due, I think, to a mixture of shame and desire to forget bitter experiences as quickly as possible by not reliving them. And yet there is also evidence that some internees kept silent about their internment for patriotic reasons. One former internee, a tobacco farmer from Texas, Queensland, called Oswald Benuto, kind of explained why he didn't really talk about his internment experience until quite late in life. He wrote in his memoir, "Internment nearly shattered my faith and love in Australia. For a long time I did not tell my son or my daughter the story of my internment. Neither my wife nor I wanted to poison their minds against their native country. We wanted them to grow up into good, loyal, proud Australians. Finally, I told them, not because I did not want them to think that my because I did not want them to think that my silence and reluctance to acquaint them with the whole matter indicated a guilty conscience, and that my internment may in fact be justified." Oswald Benuto's internment was not justified. While there were many Italians, Japanese and Germans living in Australia who either needed to be interned nor or kept under surveillance, there's no doubt about that. The majority of the thousands of enemy aliens interned, some of whom were naturalised British citizens who'd been living in Australia for years, posed little threat to the security of our country. At the time of the Second World War, the Australian government sorted all enemy aliens living into Australia into different categories. Category A covered highly suspect individuals, Nazi and Fascist Party members, criminals, mainly those suspected being involved in the Mafia, or the Black Hand as they called it, members of the enemy's armed forces. Certainly Category A aliens probably needed to be interned or at least kept watch on. Category B included people who had access to vital information or to our harbours, so any enemy alien working in the transport industry or had any understanding of logistics. Category C covered community leaders and those of influence, including anyone judged to have an anti-British history, and this actually included anti-fascists and communists. Category D covered all males of military age capable of bearing arms, and finally Category O covered everyone left over, what were normally described as the ordinary harmless people. During the parliamentary debates on the national security laws that provided for the treatment of enemy aliens during wartime, politicians made principal pronouncements about the need to balance civil rights of individuals, particularly minorities, and the need to protect the general population. Prime Minister Menzies stated that the new laws would be exercised firmly, definitely and promptly, but without intolerance and with a due respect for the interests of minorities. And yet some, such as the Labor lawyer and politician Maurice Blackburn, doubted whether the stated intentions of the Prime Minister would carry the day, given the war experience during the First World War. There had been widespread internments then, and the vast majority of them had been unnecessary. It had actually cost Australia £1.5 million to intern enemy aliens of German, Austrian and Turkish descent, money that could have been better used elsewhere, I think, in the war effort. Blackburn believed the lessons from the previous wars had not been learned and the wide-ranging powers under the new security laws would be used to detain people whose only real crime was their ethnicity. "I know how war changes the opinions of people," Blackburn said. "I know the nervous tension to which the community and ministers will be subjected." And he was right. While early waves of internments picked up aliens from categories A and B, later waves were authorised mainly in response to public anxiety about the course of the war and the possibility of a Japanese invasion. At this point in the conflict, internments were more extensive in the far north, where my family lived, and in the west, and included the detention of people who could rightly be described as ordinary harmless people. There was an uneven and, as a result, unfair approach to internment across Australia. Each state acted differently depending on how vulnerable it was to invasion. For example, Victoria had the lowest number of internments, with only 2.7% of the registered male enemy alien population arrested and detained. In contrast, in Queensland, 43% of its enemy alien population was interned. It could hardly be argued that the Queensland Italians were more disloyal than their countrymen, as if treachery had some kind of connection to humidity. My Uncle Joe and my grandfather Oreste were both interned as Category A aliens. Both were in camps from the beginning of the war until after Italy surrendered to the aliens. The Allies. There we go. That was a Freudian slip. Neither were members of the Fascist Party, but as official records show, my Uncle Joe had attended a few black shirt meetings near Innisfail in the 1930s, and my very naive and very lonely grandfather attended a few fascist meetings in Sydney run by his employer during the Depression. These were mistakes that meant that they were both interned for nearly 4 to 5 years. But the situation was very different for my great-grandfather Luigi, who was interned as a Category C alien, a man of means and influence. He was in his early 60s, a naturalised British citizen for over 20 years, and he was picked up in the weeks after the fall of Singapore. In fact, almost all Italian men in his region were picked up at that time. There was hardly any men left. The evidence against my great-grandfather was pretty thin. The only real mark against him was that an anonymous source had reported that he had been complaining in the street about a friend of his that had been interned, and he was interned for nearly 2 years. And finally let out, he had to appeal twice to the board to get let out. The historian Kay Saunders writes that the course of internment reflected actually Allied defeats on the battlefield. In a way, internment followed the pattern of the war front rather than a fair assessment of any individual's case. So as the war progressed, many enemy aliens were interned as a precautionary measure out of inflated fears about what they might do. Some aliens were interned as a result of rumour and unfounded suspicion rife in an anxious community. In her book about internment, historian Margaret Beveridge writes that ex-internees from the sugar districts of the north believe the reasons they were held captive had as much to do with local politics as they had to do with national security. Farmers suspected neighbours hoping to take over abandoned farms. A few cane cutters put down their inclusion to be interned down to attending a meeting protesting against the introduction of labour conscription. There was also evidence that some Italians were interned who opposed the policy of British preference in the sugar industry, which was something introduced actually in the 20s, which meant that a certain percentage of anybody employed in the sugar industry had to be of British origin or from a Scandinavian country. It basically excluded Italians, Greeks or anybody who was swarthy. So anybody who was active against British preference was also interned. Other internees spoke of more personal reasons, such as competition with a local policeman over a particular woman, because it was the police that actually wrote up the lists about who was to be interned, the local police, even though it was obviously a question of national security. In a moment of candour in front of the Aliens Tribunal, which was the body charged with the task of assessing internees' claims for release, and actually the setting up of this Aliens Tribunal in which people could appeal their internment was itself controversial. The government carried the day in the end. They believed that the rule of law should apply. But there was very heated parliamentary debates about it, including many members of parliament on both sides saying that actually the entire enemy alien population, man, woman and child, should be interned. But they shouldn't be released regardless. But they did set up this this tribunal to hear appeals against internment. Anyway, one of the members of one of the many tribunals that were charged with hearing these cases was named Lieutenant Colonel Sidney Whitington, and he articulated the rationale for interning aliens who were not avowed fascists. And he said, "We may not be able to provide what we say in the ordinary sense of evidence, but we can prove it in this way, that we know our people are prepared to give the tribunal sworn evidence that there is reason to believe that such and such an alien is dangerous. And in time of war, that should be itself sufficient to show that enemy aliens should not be allowed at large, that we cannot afford to risk it. He may be innocent in this way, that he has never done anything to harm the British Empire. The reason for that is he may not have had the opportunity. We have interned him not because he has done anything wrong, but because he is a potential danger to the community. Uncovering my family's experience with internment has made me reflect on my own upbringing as a third-generation migrant. What effect has it had on the way that my grandmother raised her daughter and how, in turn, my mother raised me? The war period was rarely talked about with much bitterness in my family. When it was talked about, my mother said her relatives were philosophical. Well, you know, they say we were treated well in the camps, they fed us well, which is important if you're Italian. And Italy was at war with Britain, so what can you do? They had this very kind of philosophical approach to it. But I think from my vantage point, I believe the internment experience reinforced what my Italian-born relatives already knew, which is no matter how long they lived here, no matter how hard they worked, they would not be fully accepted as Australian, but their children would be. I think this leads me to some concluding thoughts about the situation of third-generation migrants. And my work with the Ipsos Mackay Report and the research we've been doing in the last few years for SBS particularly has uncovered some very interesting insights about identity and successive generations of migrants. We conducted a large study that was released around about the time of the documentary Immigration Nation. It was both quantitative and qualitative in nature, and in the quantitative study we surveyed 13,000 Australians and we asked the question, to what extent do you feel a sense of belonging to Australia? We boosted that sample with respondents from a social and culturally and linguistically diverse household, so we could make some useful comparisons between new migrant communities and their thoughts and views and people who'd been here for a long time. What we found, I think, was really heartening. What we found is that second-generation migrants were significantly more likely to indicate that they had a sense of belonging to a great extent when compared to first-generation migrants. First-generation migrants said, about 64% said they felt a great sense of belonging to Australia, which I think is itself quite a high percentage given these are people who've been born overseas and come here. Their children, 80% of them, said they had felt a sense of belonging to Australia to a great extent. The general population in the sample was 79%. So what that means is within one generation, you have the children of migrants feeling a connection to Australia on par with the rest of the population. That's an extraordinary achievement, really. In our qualitative work, so we did numerous depth interviews and groups, this idea that the children of migrants will adapt well and quickly to their adopted home was also confirmed. Just some quotes from the research. One person said, if their kids marry Aussies, they'll bring up their kids in the Aussie way. In one generation, they'll change into an Aussie. another quote. Generally speaking, by the time you get to the second generation, especially with the Italians and the Greeks, the kids are really Australian. These are some of the comments made in previous reports we have done on the impact of social impact of immigration, reflecting a strong community belief that any problems with assimilation of the first generation will be sorted out swiftly with the second. It isn't all so rosy, though, if you actually talk to second-generation migrants beyond their sense of belonging to Australia, how they feel about other kinds of things. It isn't always as clear-cut as that. We get two groups. We get people who are trying incredibly hard to fit into the new culture, the Australian culture, and mostly they clash with their parents' culture. And to some extent, and there's a bit of a skew here with people from Arabic backgrounds, those who defiantly identify with the culture of their parents, often even more than their parents want them to. So we conducted numerous groups for this research, and in the same week I sat with a group of second-generation Vietnamese girls who were really clashing with their parents over their life choices. They were all dating what they call local boys, which basically means Aussie boys. They were fighting with their parents about that. They were fighting with their parents about the fact that they wanted to go out at night and socialise, and they were fighting with their parents about the pressure they were putting them under to succeed at school. Kind of pretty typical problems that people in their late teens and early 20s have. But one of the girls said this, I find sometimes our parents expect us to be like them when they were back in Vietnam. They try to bring us up as if we were still there, being strict. I find it hard. Back in high school, friends were allowed to do stuff and we weren't, and I never understood why. It frustrated me. Sometimes I would think, I don't want to be Vietnamese. The rules are too hard. On the other, that very same week, I sat with a Lebanese mother who'd been here for many years, and she had two teen boys who were taking very different approaches to their identity. Interestingly, they were Christian Lebanese, but because they lived in an area with a lot of other people from Muslim backgrounds, they were always being mistaken for being Muslim, and it made a very big impact on how they identified with their ethnicity. And she said, my eldest, he says, I'm Aussie, even though he doesn't look it, but that's what he says. But my youngest son, he's always drawing the Lebanese flag and blah, 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 and saying, and I say to him, hey, you're not only Lebanese, you're half and half. And he's like, no, I'm a Lebo. She went on to say, you know, everybody assumes he's Arabic. Everybody assumes he's from a Muslim background. And so he thinks, well, if you're going to assume the worst, I'm going to identify with that and see what happens with it. I think it's always talked about when looking at that second generation, that kind of sandwich generation, that the children of migrants face the challenge of growing up in the midst of two cultures. And it's understandable to feel and have a sense, an ambiguous sense of identity. Another group that we conducted as part of this research was a group of third-generation Chinese men, young men, who explained it this way. You grow up feeling like you don't really fit in, especially in Newcastle, because there isn't as big a Chinese community as, say, Sydney or Melbourne. Being Aussie-born, you sometimes feel like you don't belong in either camp. You don't feel like you belong in the fully Chinese or the fully Australian part of society. You're sort of stuck in the middle, and then neither side really wants to fully accept you. They explained what it was like to go to Chinese New Year experience, you know, Chinese New Year celebrations, and people would come up and speak Chinese to them and they couldn't speak back. And they felt this real sense of, I look Chinese, like I should be part of this culture, but I have no idea what anybody's saying to me, and that sense of alienation. For these young men, they were quite interested in learning Chinese and wanting to live in China and reconnect, and that's a very common story with the third generation. The second generation has become part of Australian society quite quickly, drop the language, drop the culture. Then the third generation, particularly if you continue to look like you're Chinese, and so if you particularly have those kinds of physical markers of your ethnic heritage, feel quite isolated and want to reconnect. I mean, it's interesting to me. I mean, I grew up as a third generation Italian being very proud of my Italian heritage. and barely acknowledging the Australian Scottish heritage of my father, which I thought was pretty uncool, to tell you the truth. It's kind of the difference between haggis and pizza. What really are you going to choose? I mean, there's no choice, is there? But I know that that was because when I was a young adult, saying you're Italian gave you a kind of sophisticated edge. And we were all at university watching Fellini films and drinking espresso, and I thought if I said I was Italian, maybe people would say I look like Sophia Loren and it would all be good. But, I mean, you know, I claimed this Italian heritage without being able to speak the language and with my only connection to the Italian community being through my grandparents. And when my grandmother died, I was acutely aware. I said, this is the end for me. I won't hear Italian in my life anymore. I won't be able to speak it. And my daughter won't really know what it's like to grow up in a bicultural household. And there was an extraordinary sense of sadness, not only of losing her, but of losing that connection to something that was so important to me. In contrast, my mother grew up at the centre of a vast Italian community, speaks the language fluently, taught it at school, lived in Italy on and off, and yet she has always had an uneasy relationship with her Italianness, a consequence absolutely of the relentless prejudice she faced as a child and a young adult. The best way to piss my mother off is to tell her she looks Italian. Everybody realised, I know it's a compliment today, but it wasn't a compliment when she was young. In many ways, writing The Italian Girl has been a way not only for me to honour my non-Nazi life, but to keep a connection with my Italian heritage now that she's gone, and really to preserve the story for the fourth generation. In a way, this book has an audience of two, my mother and my daughter. My daughter is blonde, which is quite hard for me to come to terms with. She's four, she's blonde. She doesn't look Italian at all, but I hope in reading the book she'll be able to grow up to claim her Italian heritage without trepidation. Thank you.
Many thanks, Rebecca Huntley. So Janet Grundy's got copies of Rebecca's book, The Italian Girl, and I'm sure Rebecca will be happy to sign any after the talk. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time. I just thought I'd start off with a bit of politics, but there's so many things in your book, but you mentioned internment, and it was very unfair to Italians in the Second War, as it was to Germans in the First War. And you mentioned Robert Menzies being the Prime Minister when the war started, and you mentioned Maurice Blackburn, the left-wing Labour lawyer opposing it, all of which is true, but as you yourself point out, particularly in Queensland, the internment of Italians started after the fall of Singapore.
Yes.
This is the Labor government. Now, the important point here is that the Attorney General is Bert Evatt. Bert Evatt is supposed to be the great libertarian, hero of the left. But Evatt was brutal in his administration of internment. And as I understand it, there was a public servant in Queensland, I think his name was Wade, who disliked Italians. And he was one of the reasons who drove up the high levels. He was a friend of Evatt's. So how do you, I mean, in your researches, what... do you come across any kind of criticism of Bert Evatt as the Attorney General overseeing this kind of internment, which was quite brutal and completely unnecessary for the most part?
Yes. There was some criticism, particularly the member for Kennedy, and I actually start the book with... it was quite interesting. There was opposition at a number of levels. There was certainly opposition at the church level because Italian Catholics particularly had individual members of the Catholic Church pleading the case for certain internments that were particularly harsh to be overturned. And you also had, quite movingly, people who were living next to somebody who was taken away, you know, a family who would say, you know, their friend was taken away, or their neighbour, or the guy who, fixed their shoes or ran the local delicatessen, and you had individual citizens trying to take up their case. One of the lone voices in Parliament was actually the member for Kennedy, which is the area around Innisfail, that kind of cane farming area, and I'll read his quote, which I love. His name was the Honourable Cecil Jessen, and he was the member of Kennedy and then later of Hinchinbrook, and he said, when this war is finished, if the story of internment is ever published, it will astound decent, honest Australian people. So you did have some people in Parliament questioning this, and of course the thing about Bert Evatt is that he knew even though the he knew that there was going to be unevenness because of this jurisdictional difference, this jurisdictional division, because it was really up to the local, to the state government, but mainly the local police, to draw up these lists. And so there is evidence that he knew quite well that there was going to be an uneven treatment of the enemy alien population based on whatever the local police... And he was told that, and he kind of ignored it. So that's why you don't just have, I think, that... that difference between internment in WA and Queensland because of that fear of being able to defend that part of Australia. In particularly in northern Queensland, you have decades of anti-Italian sentiment, particularly around during the Depression and particularly around the incursion of Italians in that area and the success that they had cutting cane, which was quite a lucrative job, but also buying farms. And they did it kind of, some would explain, probably see quite predatory practice of whenever there was a cyclone or a hurricane or whatever, and floods, which there are regularly up in that area, Aussie farmers would just think, I can't handle this anymore, and sell their farms cheaply to Italians. So in that period, in that the 20s and 30s, Italians managed to buy up a lot of that area. So you've got a history of an anti-Italian sentiment, a war, and there was a well known that it was going to be difficult for Italians in that area above and beyond security reasons. So a little bit of, I mean, I, as somebody who's knows a little bit about Labor history, I was a bit surprised that Bert Everett was at the apex of this particular push to...
Yes. OK, so, yes, speak up. There's a speech by Curtin in the late 1930s, I've used it myself, where he's quite anti-non-Anglo immigrants. I mean, it's just interesting that we all assume that Labor is... the smaller liberal
party.
No. Back then.
No. And the aid...
Curtin himself, you know, the man, the hero, is talking out in Parliament against non-Anglo immigrants.
And the union, the AWA at that time that covered the industry, was in general pretty anti-Italian as well and was one of the driving forces behind the Ferry Commission into the influence of Italians in the north, pretty influential in pushing for a British preference. And... you know, Italians worked incredibly hard on the smell of an oily rag. Some of them joined the union, but most of them didn't because most of them relied very closely on their own personal networks but also encountered racism in the union as well. So a very different Labor Party.
Now, just speak up. We've got plenty of time to speak up because I want to catch you in the microphone. So, yeah.
Your grandmother.
Yes.
She discovered all these wonderful talents when the men were not there.
Yes.
When the men came back, what sort of adjustments on both sides occurred between your grandmother and the men?
Question about what happened when the men came back from internment.
Look, because I never got a chance to talk to my grandmother about this when she was alive, and the one thing I say to everybody when I speak is talk to your grandparents now before they go. You might think that they're boring. You might think that they've got nothing to say, but I think 9 times out of 10 you'll discover some extraordinary things. But you have to get to a point of maturity to be able to recognise that. So, look, from what she talked about a lot with my mother, and she said there was a mixture of sadness that she had to go back into that sweltering kitchen, take off the beautiful clothes and lose some of that autonomy. But she was also incredibly... She was running these 3 cane farms at, during a time of labour shortages, during an extraordinarily difficult time, and I think in some way she was glad to have somebody else to do that. So she was... There was a mixture of relief because she was, of course, terribly scared that she'd make the wrong decision. And, of course, all... Not just... her livelihood and her parents' livelihood, but the livelihood of this extended family. You know, my grandfather, great-grandfather bought children and cousins and everybody else was reliant upon these farms. It is what he had worked for 30 years. And in farming, there's, you know, it's you live and die by the seasons. It's all very difficult. So I think there was a sense of relief. But when I talk about the book, when she died, I said to my Uncle Frank, because when she died, I was 27, unmarried, no children, living with my mother. And I said, you know, I felt so sad that I'd let her down because I hadn't got married and she didn't get to see me get married and have kids. And my Uncle Frank said, oh, she didn't care about that. You know, the best time of her life was when all the men were gone and she was running the farms, and she looks back at that as a great time of her life where she had some freedom. And she, the most proud she ever was when you got your PhD, that's when she really, that's when she was really proud. She never, and it made me realise, she never, ever, ever talked to me about weddings, talked to me about marriages, never asked if any of the boys I was going out with, I was going to marry them. She was, I'd assumed that good Italian grandmothers, the only thing they care about is marriage and kids. I was completely wrong, you know. So, yeah, she's, I think, quite modern in her outlook, but I just didn't see it, even though it was right in front of me.
Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah. Oh, then we go there. Okay.
My husband was an intern in the Hay and Dunera boy.
Oh, yes. And, he was a Dunera boy, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Wow.
So this is Hillary's husband was a Dunera boy. Okay, so right. He was one of the Germans. One of the Germans who came to Australia.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
German Jew.
Yeah. And he was, all I know is just hearsay.
Yes.
It seemed to be there were either Italians or Turns. Near Hay,
yes.
Near the camp in Tatura.
Yes.
And it seemed to me, they said, you know, the Italian kids got on with it. I don't know whether they went to the local schools, but they got on with their education.
Yes.
And it did not seem to interfere with their, you know, they didn't seem, you know, any protest about what was happening. They sort of accepted them.
No, there was a kind of a resignation about that this is what had happened. And I think that was so typical of their resignation of any kind of hardship. I mean, in the entire migrant story, it's a resignation of, you know, how awful it was on the boat, when they came here, how difficult, you know, cane cutting. There'd be a few jobs I never want to do. Cane cutting would be one of them in the North Queensland humidity. Suddenly a war happens, suddenly people are interned, suddenly a hurricane comes and destroys your house. So there is a kind of a get on acceptance.
But the kids seem to go on all right. As far as I can see, the education went on for the kids.
Yes, it did. I think one of the things I've found is that is the general experience, that people kind of got on with it. But there are other, within that there are some really heartbreaking stories. There was numerous examples of young men of Italian origin fighting for Australia overseas to come back to find out that their father had been interned. In WA was one of the few places that interned both men and women. Not many women, but enough their children had to be placed in foster care. And so the interviews with those children, they were quite... so that kind of impact was terrible. And, of course, there was a man killed in one of the camps, an anti-fascist killed by a fascist, and that's when they kind of... The authorities kind of decided that maybe we should put the fascists over here and the anti-fascists over there and kind of divide these people. And that was interesting to me about the kind of culture of the camps, is that for the Australian authorities, all Italians were the same. But if you ever talk to it, not all Italians are the same. You know, you put northerners and southerners... My grandfather said he'd never talk to a southerner. My great-grandfather said I'd never talk to a southerner until I was interned with them, and even then I tried to avoid them. So that terrible northern prejudice, and, of course, that kind of, you know, if you intern the very politically active on both extremes of the spectrum, then you're likely to get some trouble. So there was a man murdered. So there was, I think, a spectrum of experience, because there was a spectrum of different kinds of people interned, because not the same kinds of people were put in there. But I think, you know, I think what is interesting to me is that parallel story of uncertainty, of just trying to get on in a difficult situation, and also of the women being forced to step up in absence of the men, that I was very familiar with in the broader story of the home front in Australia, but I had no idea had a kind of echo within these communities as well. But, yeah, I'd love to talk to you after, because I didn't know much about the Nera boys until I started researching. Extraordinary story.
One of our good friends, Hugo Wilson, was on the Dunera, and Henry Mayer, and who else?
Molly. Now my husband. Fred's no longer with us.
Right.
And Fred Gruen was on the Dunera. He was the father of David Gruen.
Yes.
Yeah, so they all had connections with the Sydney Institute, and they're all dead now, but they're all good friends of ours. Yes.
When you say about enemy aliens, many of them were in fact pretty subject to naturalising.
Yes.
In a way, they felt betrayed because they were not respected for that reason.
Yes.
But on the other side of the coin is they were, that was loss of freedom for them. On the other hand, a lot of them didn't speak about their experiences as internees, I think, because they were conscious of the fact that other Australians were, in fact, suffering and fighting to preserve their freedom. That's kind of a perverse situation to be in. And it's never mentioned in, you know, I've been doing some amateur research in the National Archives, and that's fascinating, and that doesn't seem to appear anywhere.
No, it is interesting. There were very mixed feelings about being in the camp. I mean, I asked my mum about it and she said, well, in some ways, this was the biggest holiday they'd ever had. you know, these were men who were used to working 7 days a week and suddenly they were in kind of the South Australian... And of course, evidenced by the fact that they played a lot of sport and they put on opera and they did a lot of arts and craft. If you ever go to Loveday, and there's a whole kind of museum in Loveday and there's all the kind of arts and crafts. And some of them learnt English. And they spent their time getting an education because there were some quite educated people who were interned who ran English lessons. So in a sense, they kind of felt, I mean, obviously anxious about what was happening at home, but also on a bit of a holiday for the first time in a long time. Like I said, they were fed particularly well. Some of them were released to be able to work outside the camps for small amounts of money, mostly in... mostly in kind of road works and but also agriculture. So it was it wasn't like they were treated badly, and in fact most of the stories are that they got on reasonably well with the camp administrators but very badly with each other. But most of the tension was internal. But you're right, and there was a sense that, you know, that they would rather be in the camp than on the war front, on the front lines. And I think that's evidenced by the fact that there seems to have been, certainly in Loveday, quite a lot of activity from particularly the communists to raise money for the Red Cross and for the Allied effort. And in fact, that was one of the reasons why the man who was the anti-fascist who was killed was actually killed. The fascists had found out that they had raised quite a lot of money within the camp for the Allied effort. There were newspapers that both... fascists and anti-fascists that produced, and they got very, very angry and at the fascist and singled out this particular one and killed them. So there was a recognition that the broader fight was being had and greater sacrifice was being made in order for them to one day be released from the camp and go on about their lives. So it's not a, as everything is in history, not a black and white story. And there were certainly some people who, like I said, needed to be interned. I went into this thinking, oh, everybody was innocent, but there were some people who really did need some serious surveillance. And there are other people that were just caught up. Like when I was in Israel, I went for numerous trips, and this is my favourite story, and I couldn't find any actual archival confirmation of the story, but I was in the Israel Historical Society, which is basically a room at the top of the art centre in Israel, and I was introduced to an older man. My uncle introduced me to an older man. So I remember your great grandfather. So I remember the day they took the Italians away. So I was a young boy, I was with my brother, and the local copper said, "Oh look, we're sending the Italians down to Townsville to be processed. So we're just going to get some sandwiches for them for the trip." And they said they went to the local deli and got the guy to make up all these sandwiches. And then they got the guy to put the sandwiches in the truck, and then they closed the door on the guy because he was Italian, and they were taking him to the. It's a terrible. I laugh, but then he said, and the guy said to me, "I never let the look on his face." And we just left the deli, kind of just there, door open, you know. And so, you know, you hear stories about women who went off to have babies, who came back and found out that there was no one. The men had been taken from the farm. So there were that kind of extraordinary shocks that happen to people, and that in itself is really difficult. But in terms of actually what happened to them in the camps, it was a pretty nice life compared to the life they lived outside the camp. And also it's important to note that for women left behind, they got a stipend from the government. I mean, this was an extraordinary expensive and a very, very expensive process, not only in order to feed and clothe and house. I mean, there were purpose-built camps, support the women who were back home, do all these, also deprive Australia of that labour at that time, although some of it was directed into the agriculture industry. So it was a very expensive experiment. It was a very expensive thing to do. So that in itself is a bit of a tragedy, I've got to say. So.
Now we've got plenty of time. So we're going to go to Jeff, and then we're going to go up here, and then we're going to get down the back, and we're over there. But just so, I mean, there are maps in this book, but Loveday is northeast of Adelaide,
yes.
Which is what, it's about an hour and a half out of Adelaide,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's where the Loveday internment camp was. Jeff, yeah.
The second generation Italian people who were interned in your area, because there were also second generation people, Italians that I know of,
yes.
Who went to fight,
yes. Yes.
Before. So there seems to be a sort of a bit of ambiguity, inconsistency.
Yeah. Look, it was mostly, being naturalised didn't exclude you from being considered to be an enemy alien, but there were very few people who were born in Australia who were interned. You had to have a very, there had to be a really, really clear reason why they interned you. So that you probably needed to be Category A or Category B, so somebody who, your name was seen on a kind of fascist membership list. It was really people who were born overseas. But like I said, naturalisation didn't prevent you from being interned. In fact, it's interesting about naturalisation. It seems that there was a view formed within some kind of political and police circles that naturalisation was actually almost an indication of guilt. Because at the time, you could only own land if you were naturalised. So naturalisation compared to, let's say, becoming an Australian citizen now was actually easier. You needed to have a number of years of residency in Australia. You had to have two Australian-born, you know, Aussies vouch for you, and you had to pay a certain amount of money. And the push to become naturalised was very strong because you couldn't own land. And most Italians came here to own land, to own their own property. And so there was quite a lot in both the archival material as well as some of the secondary material I've read where people thought, look, just because he's naturalised, it's just about money. It's got nothing to do with commitment to Australia. And, of course, naturalisation was really just becoming a naturalised British citizen rather than committing yourself to Australia as well. But there's also very clear evidence, and I think that was very clear from my great-grandfather, that Australia was his home. It was the place that he felt gave him an opportunity to educate his kids and provide for his children, and you know, it was in the files that I've read of his, he's talked very much about, I have children, I have great grandchildren, this is their home, of course I want Australia to win because this is my country. You know, I feel sorry for Italy, I don't like Mussolini, I feel sorry for what Italy's going through, but this is my country. So naturalisation for him wasn't just about, it might have been initially about owning land, but in the end it wasn't. But it was discounted by people. But to go back to your question, there were very few Australian-born Italians that were interned. And, of course, the stories of men going away to fight for Australia only to find out when they came back that their father was interned must have been a very strange experience, a very strange experience.
Question here.
Yes.
No,
likewise, I'm doing some amateur research,
yes.
For the Historical Society.
Yes.
And recently I did an interview with an Italian man who had been conscripted into the Italian army,
right.
In Italy, was captured with Rommel's army, mm-hmm. in North Africa,
yes.
And sent out to Australia. And was in Kaura camp,
mm-hmm.
when the Japanese breakout,
right.
occurred. He said he and his compatriots saw the buildings burning and hid under the beds.
Mm.
Afterwards, they were sent to Liverpool, and he had relatives, cousins, living round about.
Mm.
Somebody brought him in some ordinary clothes so that the red was too obvious.
Yes.
And the guards, at the camp, he would go out.
We've got to be brief.
Yes.
And all these relatives would, Italians would all get together.
Yes.
And then he'd come back into the camp.
Yes.
But he got caught.
Yeah.
And he developed a relationship with the people in the camp,
yes,
taught them how to make wine,
yes,
from other things, brought seedlings in from
And
we're all an Italian community.
Yes. Yeah, the POW experience was very different to the enemy alien internee experience. In fact, of all the evidence I've seen, POWs that came here were pretty glad not to be fighting for not very organised Italian forces in the African desert, and pretty happy to be here. And in fact, there's many stories of them when the war ended, they came back to Australia.
Yes,
yes.
It was the community.
No, we've got to move on. I'm sorry.
That was important, yes.
Yeah. Right, there's a question right down the back. We've got to be brief, okay? Yeah.
Yes, you mentioned about the internal. Do you think the US internment program influenced Australia's world in terms of Japanese and everything? Is it your grandmother saying, oh, my cousin who went to the US got interned as well? It wasn't too bad in Australia.
Okay, so the question is whether the Australian authorities were influenced by the decision of the Roosevelt administration in the United States to intern mainly Japanese, right?
Look, I don't know much about the... I'm certainly not an expert on the American experience. My understanding is that they interned many more percentage of the Japanese population than they did of the Italian and German population. And they certainly interned a greater percentage... We certainly interned a greater percentage of our Italian and German population than they did. We interned 97% of our Japanese enemy alien population in Australia, which was much smaller. I've read accounts that said there was almost a public safety aspect to that, in that that community was going to be, given the understandable concern around Japanese invasion, that they could have almost been harmed quite badly and set upon. There's not a lot of examples of Italians and Germans who were in the local, living in the community at large, attacked by Australians. There were some shops, certainly some racism, but not a great physical threat to them. But it doesn't seem that there's any connection. In fact, the Australians had their own, they had their own position about internment that wasn't connected to the US position. I don't think that's a connection. I think it's their own decision about who to intern and the extent was a very much a local one. I remember a couple of months ago I was lucky enough to have dinner with Justice Scalia from the US Supreme Court. He was telling me about this project. Of course, he's an Italian background. And he said, why would you intern that many Italians and Germans when you're so far away from everything? He said, we couldn't afford a war if we interned that percentage of our Italian population. And we couldn't afford it. And maybe that was the thing, because that we actually aren't talking about tens and thousands of people. We're talking about thousands. It was more... It was doable in Australia in a way that it wasn't in America. And I just think it's interesting to see those differences. There's been numbers of books written about the comparative experience of internment in Australia, the US and Canada, that might be able to answer those questions.
We're going to a question here.
During the war, and we used to go to the farm up in Casino, up there. We had Italian POWs,
yes,
and Italian internees,
yep,
and the attitude was changing throughout the whole of the war, and by the time at the end it was just perfectly casual. Everybody wasn't really worried about anything.
Yes.
It was a great big party. We just went through the motions.
Mm.
Yeah.
And because food was provided and money was provided to the farms that they were working on,
yes,
they were very popular.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I just regard it as a great time.
A great time. second last question. Yeah.
There was another phrase, alien conscription.
Yes.
A friend of mine who, before she was born, her father, when her older sisters were small babies, was taken away in during the war in Italian.
Yes.
But he went to an alien conscription.
He went to the Civil Aliens Corps.
And now, is there a difference
in terms of the men who went from Innisfail,
yes,
they were literally interned. In other words, they yes. didn't have to work. Whereas there were others that were taken away, and they were called the alien conscription yeah. camps.
Yes.
They were actually used to work, chopboard, whatever.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes.
As you're talking about as Victorian camps.
Yeah, and I'm yes. just wondering okay. to what extent the states, in Queensland being, Innisfail being a little bit more inclined to big fights with the locals or
yes.
whatever,
yep.
races, whatever you want to call it, yep. Whether there was some difference between the ways in which different groups were handled.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And if you're from that particular part of North Queensland and you're Italian and given the anti-Italian sentiment in that area, and also, you know, given its position, there's lots of stories from my aunts talking about, you know, hearing the planes go overhead and all the rest of it, there was serious concern. No, there was no... They all went straight to Townsville, to Gaythorne, to be processed. Then they went briefly to Hay and then eventually to Loveday. When Italy was out of the war, my grandfather had the option to work in the Civil Aliens Corps, which he did, in Alice Springs, right. basically yeah. working along the road. Some internees had the opportunity, who weren't high risk, had the opportunity to, if they wanted to work outside the camp for a small amount of money, but it was optional. So, yes, there seems to be, and that's the thing I think about internment, not about war generally, is just how uncertain it is that it was going to happen. So, like I said, there was a very... You could have exactly the same profile and be living in New South Wales and have a very, very different war experience as an Italian than if you were living in North Queensland or WA. So much so that there are even still people in the Italian community who know about internment but assume everybody who is interned did the wrong thing because they weren't interned. And in the discussions that I've been having in the Italian community, they're like, oh, really? Is that all that your great-grandfather did? I thought that it was, you know, there were lots and lots of fascists, lots and lots of people, and they must have done something wrong to be interned. So,
final question. Hmm. When you were last here, you spoke about research you'd done, and you are now a professional researcher
yes.
with your as your main employment. So you spend most of your life these days writing about other people.
Yes.
But on this occasion, in this book, you've written about yourself and your family. Did you enjoy it, and would you go back to it?
Did I enjoy it? I went in thinking, isn't this an interesting... I'm going to write a little bit about history and about my grandmother, and then ended up finding out a lot of stuff about my mother that's necessarily in the book. And it was naive to think I could write about my grandmother and it not become, you know, suddenly very personal. So, yes, I found out my mother's parents were first cousins, and they're basically from a long line of first cousins, so which is kind of probably quite socially embarrassing. But so it might be why I've got curly hair, but I'm kind of lucky that I only... And I found out, too, that that's the reason why my grandparents only had one child. They were so scared about the... genetic abnormalities that could have. So there was a lot of very personal stuff. Found out my great-grandfather was gay and had an obsession with John Farnham. And so there are those kinds of things that are out there, which perhaps means that I can never enter politics. So I can imagine that I've provided the opposition with, a ready kind of a dossier and already all my... I think what I tried to do is apply some of the researcher techniques I had to the people around me in my own personal life, but it's never that simple. And, of course, there's a bias there. I want to think the best of my grandparents, and I want to think the best of my family, but some of the things that they did and some of their attitudes were kind of stupid and questionable and worrisome. Their northern superiority, anti-southern sentiment, anti-Aboriginal sentiment... is still quite troubling. So it's all there. It's all there. I don't think I'll do it again though. But I'm glad that I did it mainly so that my daughter gets to know the story. And in fact, I found out an enormous amount of information that no one in my family knew. They didn't actually really know why a lot of their relatives, the actual basis for their internment, because most of the time internees only knew. We've only had a scanty understanding of why they were interned as well. So I found out all of that because it's all available through the National Archives, which is a wonderful service, an extraordinary service. We're very lucky to have it. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.